We are traveling to Malawi in southeastern Africa to talk art, tech, and living abroad with artist, designer, educator, and mentor, Kristen Palana. Please join us. Welcome to Art Ladders, The Creative Climb with Valerie Allen and Armin Merzman. This podcast is focused on interviews, features, and stories about art. It's for artists and art lovers. I'm Val. I'm the abstract artist in the group, joined by Armin, the realist. Hello. Hello, everyone. We are on episode 57, and today we have a special guest coming in all the way from Lilongwe, Malawi, and her name is Kristen Palana. And so we're going to start talking with her in just a moment, but I want to say hi to Armin. Hello, Armin.
How's it going?
Going great.
So, hi, Kristen. It's very nice to meet you. And I had some time to check out your beautiful works too. So that was a nice little journey for me too. So
thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you and to talk with both of you.
Yes. And Kristen, I just want to let the folks know that you're out there in southeastern Africa. You're going to tell us all about that in Malawi. You are an artist, an educator. You're also a designer and a mentor for artists. And excited. You and I met during a class I took from you on social media and web design. And oh my goodness, I obtained so much knowledge from you. So thank you for that. So how are you, Kristen? So great to see you.
Yes, likewise. I feel like I'm somewhere in Michigan, USA right now. Just I know that your listeners don't see you right now, but it's just really lovely to connect with you again. You know, our paths have crossed in the Maestrius class and events that we've been a part of. And I really enjoyed having you in the social media class and just following you on social media and seeing all the shows that you're in and the work with Art Ladders and everything else. So it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. And I'm excited because now you can meet the other half, Armin, and that's fun. We can have a wonderful conversation here today. Now, I usually start out by asking our guests their art background as a young person, and I would love to hear that from you. Your bio also mentions that you are American Portuguese, so I want to hear all about that too. So tell us about your journey. Your younger self journey.
Are you saying I'm not young? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yes, you are young. You are so young.
But even when you were younger. You know?
Even younger.
Yeah. Younger. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. So I am a late generation X. On a good day, I might be confused for an old millennial. One interesting thing that I just think is interesting about the Generation X is that they say we're kind of like a bridge generation between the old world and the new world, in that our childhoods were a bit more like our parents and our early adulthoods are more like our children with the technology and everything coming up. So my childhood was mostly spent in the 80s, growing up late 70s as a young child, 80s, early 90s in southeastern Massachusetts, USA, in a small town called Swansea. And the exposure that I had to art, I didn't really know any artists as a young kid, other than maybe what I saw on TV. Bob Ross, was an early exposure on PBS. I was fascinated with his hair as well as his trees. But
so did you know that he didn't like that hair thing? They made him do that.
Really? No, I did not know that. I thought he just rolled out of bed.
A great biography about Bob Ross that I watched, and he was fighting it all the way. They said, "No, that's your symbol." And, sorry to interrupt you, but it just reminded me of that. interesting wow. fact about Bob Ross. I used to watch Bob Ross too, but mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, I had no idea. So I'm just trying to picture him now in some makeup stylist chair getting that do made for him. But yeah. I thought I read that he didn't take any money for that entire series, that he did it for free as a public service, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah, he was a very kind mm-hmm. man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was my earliest exposure. But I guess as a young child, I remember being in kindergarten, and I went to public school, you know, K through 12, and there were not a lot of art supplies, and we had these buckets of crayons. And I just remember the teacher would say, okay, tables, you go up and get your crayons. And we run up, and there were two buckets that had something other than the primary colors, like some light blue, maybe a pink. So those were considered the good colors just because they were rare and hard to come by. And I remember this anxiety that we would all feel trying to get these buckets of colors. But aside from that, we thankfully did have art class in grade school once a week. And from that, I kind of got that early rare praise of being sort of good at something, which I think, Armin, you've mentioned in your childhood as well. Are you getting right. that early, you know, push or praise that kind of then moves you forward a little bit more to explore yeah. further? So I continued to make art in junior high and high school. And I think it was around the age of 14 that I even realized that there were entire universities and colleges devoted to art. You can actually do that. And I'm lucky and unlucky, but lucky in the fact that I'm the first person in my family to have graduated and to go into university. And somehow I escaped the expectations that, no, you can't be an artist. You can't get a job in that. I was really lucky that nobody really discouraged me. So that was a path that I pursued. I went to Massachusetts College of Art and Design mm-hmm. in the 90s. It's the only, I think it remains the only state art school in the country. So I was able to go and not take out humongous loans. And then later, I studied painting. And then later I studied computer graphics and interactive media at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York, in like around 1999. And that I did have to take out some student loans for. So it's that's basically kind of my educational journey to that mm-hmm. point.
Excellent, excellent. And the computer training at Pratt, wow, I can see that really paid off for you because of all the different collaborations and projects that you've worked on. Now, about your heritage, tell me about that.
Sure. So I'm American and Portuguese. I have two passports, and that made my life actually a lot easier in the earlier 2000s when I was teaching and working in Rome, Italy, because having a European passport just made my life a lot easier when it came to paperwork and permissions to work in Europe. But I didn't have that passport until 2003. So I grew up, I was born in the US, but Portugal and a handful of other European countries, they allow you to become a citizen if your parent, grandparent or great-grandparent come from that country. So Ooh. Portugal, Ireland, and Italy, I believe, are three examples of that. And I learned that, and I took advantage of that because my mother, she had to get her Portuguese citizenship before I could get mine, but her parents were born in Portugal. So it was just like a little international loophole that uh-huh. I was able to take part in, but it did take a couple of years for the paperwork to go through to get all of that. So if anyone in your audience wants to explore getting a second passport, which is amazing to have, definitely start to do your homework and look into it, but just be aware it might not happen overnight. It takes a little time.
Thinking about getting I was born in Germany and mm-hmm. I became an American citizen, I think, when I was 14 or something like that. So I was exploring it a little bit to get dual citizenship, to have a German citizenship, but I was turned off by all the paperwork and all the, you know, the stuff. So I didn't do that. But it sounds like it's advantageous for you.
Yeah, it can be. My husband's actually German, and my sons are German and American. Okay. So, maybe for them it was easier because having one German parent and one American Portuguese parent, and they were born in Italy. So we just went to both embassies and we just figured it out, but it was a big headache. But I have, my husband is only has the German passport. And at one point when we lived in the US, he had the green card. And then when we moved to Italy, he gave up the green card because it didn't make sense anymore. But I know each country has its own rules. Germany loves its paperwork and bureaucracy. Yeah. But if you really did want to get it, I think you could. I'm not quite sure, especially you were born there. So I think it wouldn't be a problem. It just might be a bit of a headache, Kopfschmerz.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Kristen, you bring up so many different countries that you've been in. Your knowledge about passports and things like that, and knowing that that would be advantageous for you to have the two passports. What brought about all this travel in your life?
It's very. I didn't know if I was going to bring this up or not, but in my family right now, I have a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old, and the topic of neurodiversity has been a reoccurring theme over the last few years. And my older son has something called dyspraxia and ADHD, which I actually see in him are as strengths, not necessarily as weaknesses, although some people may see certain aspects of that as challenges. But it's interesting. And my younger son may have ADHD, but it hasn't been diagnosed. But it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot this past week, especially talking to my husband. If I was a child in 2023, what would they be diagnosing me with? Because it just wasn't really a thing when I was a kid. And as I read about adults, for example, like adult women with ADHD, I'm like, And so as you say, like, what brings you to study all these different disciplines? What makes you move to all these different countries? I might venture to say that I might somewhere beyond this spectrum of ADHD or this interest and compulsion to want to just do lots of different things. I'm a very curious person, and it could just be that I'm a very curious person, but I just thought I'd throw it out there. You never know.
I have OCD, and I always tell people, use your abbreviation, whatever it is, to your advantage. So you can sit there and mope and, oh my God, I have this, or you can use it. And I've decided I'm going to use it.
I feel that artists, and I think you nailed it with the curiosity concept of it, because Arvin knows I get all these crazy ideas going at once, and it does make me think what drives this? What's this? But curiosity can be very, very powerful. So absolutely. I bet you, I know that has a lot to do with what you're doing. So like I mentioned in the introduction,
I talk a lot about being in the zone, that your sanctuary, child, and moved to this country, didn't speak the language and all that. But it was a sanctuary for me, drawing. It was a place I could hide away from the rest of the world. And that stayed with me to this day. Is that something that happened with you as well?
Absolutely. In fact, I used to joke that I couldn't possibly have ADHD because I go into these long periods where I have to be alone and I absolutely zone out, and it's like a hyper focus. And then I look up, you know, or you could call it flow, as some people call it. But then actually earlier this week, I was reading that is sometimes considered a symptom of ADHD, this almost like hyper focus, like having to be alone, having to completely isolate yourself from distractions. And that's definitely, even when I was, I've been a university professor for many years, sometimes I'd have my own office. In other universities, I would be sharing an office, but I would sometimes have to put a sign on my door. I'm very social and friendly, but I absolutely could not function if I didn't have these little pockets of time just to, and that could also just be an introvert thing, but so that's another, thread. but just being able to sort of recharge, but also kind of reduce the stimulus around me, the conversations, the people. So it's interesting. Are you both kind of like that with your own studios as well? I think in an earlier podcast, you said that at one point you shared a studio, but now you have your own. Is that right?
That is absolutely true. Our tastes in music
are like 2 weeks.
Yeah. The music thing was a definite. And I do. I remember in one studio putting up a little tape that said, do not talk to the artist, because you do. That focus is so important. And I'm the type of artist that will, when I'm working, it will be several days in a row of very heavy focus, not getting out much, just work, 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 where Armin is the type of artist that can work every day. And I really admire that discipline. But I get this huge burst of energy, and then I just dive in and then come out on the other side about 4 or 5 days later. And
what about you, Kristen, that kind of aspect? Do you you have a setup day and you work every day? I know you spend your time between illustration kind of things, design, graphic design, and fine art, and you teach. That's a whole lot of different hats to wear. Are there days when, you know, you'd rather be wearing one hat than the other?
I think so. I feel like by wearing different hats, they make me appreciate the ones I'm not wearing that day. So when I, you know, if I'm and vice versa. So for example, last week I did an intensive 3-day sort of masterclass here with locals and international people in Malawi on social, very similar actually to the class that Val took, but a 3-day, 12 hours over 3 days, websites and social media. And I really enjoyed that. Really just, I enjoy making, I think I do well with people who do get distracted easily, keeping their interest and getting them interested and explaining complex things in a simple way. Mm-hmm. So when I'm not teaching, like when I first moved to Malawi, basically the last 7 years I've been living in Myanmar and Malawi, and in both of these countries, they're developing countries. And art is not something taught in the public schools, not at the elementary level, not in the secondary level, in the university level, not even, which was distressing for me coming in, you know, from, you know, teaching as a university professor since 2000 and 2002 full time to suddenly, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with myself? Mm-hmm. So, I have an art practice. I get up very early and I try to make a minute. I mean, if I have a lot of things going on, it might only be 15 minutes a day, but most of the time, if I'm lucky, I can do 1 to 3 hours in the morning. Say it used to be only, you know, 8 to 9 o'clock before my work day doing design work for UN organizations or whatever would start. And gradually I'm getting greedier and greedier. So then it's become like 8 to 10 a.m. The other day was till 11 a.m. and weekends I might do like 5 hours. Other days I might only have 10 minutes, but I really, really, really try to do 7 days a week if I can. If I can't, if I'm traveling or something happens, I don't beat myself up over it, but I really try to make sure that not more than a day goes by, because I feel like I need it. I just like to make that little, even if it's just a couple lines, that little bit of progress, or I made a decision about something. There's some days when I'm just in the zone, and other days it's like decisions need to be made, and it might look ugly and like a train wreck, but at least I decided like, okay, this is going to go there and that's going to go here.
Mm-hmm. Interesting you say that. I like hearing that, because I tell my students, have a place where you don't have to put stuff away. Because if you have to put stuff away and then get it out again, That's going to discourage you from even doing it. As long as you have some, 15 minutes can turn into an hour. Yeah. But even if it's only 15 minutes, it kind of sparks your imagination and your concepts and makes you feel whole with the piece. You know, there's days I'm so, you know, filled up with stuff, but I'll get a half hour in or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it's very, very healthy to work every day like that and get into a few zone, into the zone world for just a minute. It's a, you know, for me, I have up and down with anxiety, where art actually can calm me down and make me feel much better. So, you know, it's the art, even though I do work in those heavy concentrated segments, those little minutes that I can grab in the day where I'm thinking about art or writing about art, I go back in the zone. And that's very, very healing, I feel, for folks. It's very healthy, healthy way to live. So, you know, with the moving and everything, and like Armin was saying, it's good to have a spot. Do you have a hints on how, when you move into a brand new location, new country, new culture, how, and you with your family, tips on how to feel at home, how to settle yourself, kind of your routine to make your house into a home in these new locations, in your studio, a home?
That is a great question. It's interesting because I moved to Malawi with my family in 2019. And when I moved here, I didn't consider myself to be a fine artist. I have a background in digital media and animation and as an animator. And it was actually, so this is like my home studio slash office, but it started out just as my desk and my laptop where I did my digital media. And it only kind of like became a bit more studio-like. I'll have another studio, thankfully, at the place where I do teaching across town. And I try, like Armin says, not to have to move the stuff back and forth. I try to keep things here and things there. When we move again, so this is a moving year, and I don't know yet where we're going to be moving, because my husband's with the World Food Program, and I left the American University of Rome in 2016. I did a 2-year leave of absence because things are going really well there for me in terms of job security, but the salaries were, you know, more of an Italian salary. My husband had an international salary, but not the ability to stay in one place. They were all moving every 3 years. So we decided as a family, okay, let's go out into the field. This will be an adventure. I'll take a leave of absence. And so that's what we did. We ended up in Myanmar for 3 years and then for 4 years. And now we're going to be moving again. But the crux of the matter is I can't tell you where we're going to move next, which is a weird situation to be in. And I think it fills other people with horror.
Yes.
Sometimes it fills us with horror too, but we also kind of see it as an adventure. And we know that wherever we move to, it's going to be home because it's our family. We'll, you know, like we have a system. One of my systems is we move to the place, I immediately start learning a bit of the local language. I can't say that one of the languages here in Malawi is called Chichewa. And I got my readings down and everything, but I'm far from fluent in it. But English is also a national language, which helps a lot. But learning a bit of the language, meeting people before you move there, maybe on social media, finding those groups of expats who live in such and such a country. They can kind of give you the tips and tricks. I think for me, it's getting the kids settled, getting their school all set up and getting them off, making contacts with other artists, educators, and consultants before we arrive. And then once you're on the ground. So sorry, there's a long, convoluted answer, but I hope it gives you at least an idea.
It's a great answer because you wrote a book, Live, Love, and Work Abroad. And you wrote it back in 2017. I haven't read it yet. I kind of want to read it, Armin, because it'd be kind of fun to travel and live abroad for a while, maybe even Germany, which would be back to your home roots. But that book you wrote in 2017, and your audience, this was all pre-pandemic. Any thoughts on how you would morph that book into like a new edition?
And it probably does need a new edition. It's interesting because when I knew that we were going to be moving, I started to think like, okay, well, what am I going to do? You know, I mean, I was coming from like a tenured position, director of a film and digital media program, which was fine, but it wasn't always the best fit for me. I was coming originally from an art program where I was teaching, and then I moved to a communication program where I brought in the digital media and the design. And I always tried to play nice with the fine art department, and we had some courses together, but there's always sometimes a little distrust, sometimes between the traditional arts. I always try to be a good bridge person. Yes. But anyway, I was trying to think like, well, what am I going to do when we move? Because I don't even know where we're moving to. We didn't even know in 2016 where we were moving to. So I started to ask myself, how do you make a living when you don't live anywhere? And that's when I started to explore a little bit teaching online, because that you can do from anywhere. And then I noticed as I became involved with, first I became involved with the University for Peace in Costa Rica. They had an online program, which is was a diploma in social innovation. So it was about humanitarians and educators and artists and just people that wanted to sort of have, you know, have a positive, make positive change in the world. Basically a diploma for people who are still idealists after the age of 15 or whatever, like myself. And so I started teaching online for them. And then I started teaching for Udemy. And long story short, when I started meeting some of the other online instructors, I found that they were writing eBooks. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I learn visually, but I also learn by doing. And so, of course, I read about like, oh, how do you self-publish? How do you do an ebook? But for me to really learn, I wrote the books that you're talking about. The first one, actually, the first one was a crowdfunding book. Because I did a lot of these kind of small crowdfunding projects for various causes over the years as part of my web design and social media and digital media classes at university. And I got kind of tired of everyone asking me to tell them how to crowdfund. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to write a book. And then when people ask me, I'll be like, read the book.
Just read the book.
Read the book. Wow. And then from that came the book that you mentioned, Live, Love, and Work Abroad. And I kind of did it like video game levels. So level one is I want to learn about the world, but I'm stuck living in one town and I don't know if I'll ever get out. Maybe I'll never get out. How can I bring the world to me, to my doorstep? So that's part one. And then the next part is actually going abroad. A lot of Americans, especially, I think only 10% of Americans own a passport. And so when you're in a big country, I think Australia sometimes can be like that as well. When you're in this big country, kind of isolated, not, you know, bordering many other countries, you kind of get in your little silo. So just, you know, branching out, trying to go on your first trip. And then maybe you want to do an internship or something a little bit like a volunteer 2 weeks abroad or a small job abroad. And then the advanced levels were actually working abroad long term. And then my advanced level is you married someone who's not from your country and now you're living abroad. You gave birth abroad. That's really advanced. So that's kind of like how it all panned out. So that was that book. And then I did one about specifically working abroad and all the different aspects of it. And that I think was 2018 or 19 with Jacqueline Seidel, an Australian. So we wrote the book together.
Oh, how interesting. So
when you say that too, when you're talking about Portuguese, I read somewhere that's the best place to be an expat is in Portugal.
So yeah, I think they've set up their laws and taxes to be friendly to people who want to live there and work there.
Wow. You know,
I didn't answer your question about how I would change it post-pandemic.
Oh,
I
don't maybe we're moving on. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, well, I would just say that I feel like those books preceded the pandemic, but we're kind of like a precursor to this world that we're in now, where you can, you know, you can work abroad, you can work from anywhere. It's just, I think the pandemic, I know you've heard it said before from others as well, It's just accelerated that process of being a little bit more location independent, more opportunities opening up that don't require you to physically be in some location.
Mm-hmm. It did.
Find that in some ways to be have an advantage by teaching online and other than in person? Because, you know, I started off working, teaching online because I had to because COVID. And then, you know, you had to learn all these programs. You had to get the cameras and that camera and all this kind of stuff that was going on. And I still teach online because there are certain advantages. One of them is you get people from all over that you couldn't do in a physical class. But I can also use Photoshop and things like that to show them different things like that. And now, how do you feel about teaching online and teaching in person? Is there a difference there for you?
I love both of them in their own way. I think at first, there's also different kinds of teaching online. I think if I have my way and I can teach, we're having a Zoom call right now, this is a live experience, even though we're in different geographic locations, and then it's recorded and then people can tune in later, et cetera.
Right.
So that's kind of cool. And mentoring with Mastrius has been wonderful for that. I've got the navigator / person also running the mentorship sessions with me, Erin. She's in Berlin. She's a Canadian living in Berlin, Germany. And then the group members are mostly in Canada, North America. I don't think we have anyone in Australia in this particular group right now, but it's a rolling admission, so you never know who's going to join. Mm-hmm. But I love that, having people from everywhere. But then, you know, I live in Malawi, and it's one of the world's poorest countries, and it's sobering and humbling. And I just love being able to mentor artists and non-artists and to meet them in person and show them stuff, because not everybody has the internet, you know, not everyone has the internet access or a computer. Or, you know, even when I'm teaching online media, even last week, I had to bring extra laptops with me so that students could work on some of the hands-on things, because they just had a phone which just happened to be broken that day, or, you know, whatever it is. So I feel like there's pros and cons. I feel like maybe my energy comes through even better in person, but I think it can also come through in the live sessions.
Well, it's coming through pretty good now.
Oh, good. That's great. Yeah. The self-contained video courses, on the other hand, when you're just recording something that then people can access whenever they want, those are fine. But I find the engagement can be really low because people just kind of dip in and then maybe they do 30 seconds. And it's not like sitting in front of someone and making the eye contact and having that interaction. So unless they're really self-motivated, it can be a bit harder to get someone to learn that way, unless they're really self-motivated.
Right.
Well, I'm glad you brought up your mentorship with Mastrius. We've been talking about that on some of our other podcasts. And I witnessed you working online over Zoom when your class, and you come across as so warm and approachable. And I encourage people to check that out. If you do want to join a mentor group with Kristen, you can. It's a rolling group, right? Like you mentioned. So you can find her right there at mastrius.com as well. And that's basically how you and I met. And it is a global community, and you bring it to the forefront with that global feel. So I'm so happy that we met for that. Now your artwork explores many, many social issues and personal issues, and they're very, very universal. I know this is all audio for folks, but can you put into words your practice to kind of bring it to life for the viewer? We will be posting on social media your imagery and that sort of thing, but I just think it would be fun to listen to you describe it in words.
Sure. I'll try. Okay. It is hard to describe in words. Well, like I said, I started out as a painter. Ironically, in art school, drawing was my least favorite subject. And now it's my favorite thing to do. In fact, I'm not even painting. I call myself mixed media just right now, but it mostly is drawing. It's only painting when I've messed up the drawing and I need to paint over it a little bit, and then I'm going to draw over that.
Sure.
So I started out as a painter, but then I, you know, what happened is I just didn't know if I could make a living as a fine artist back in the day. And I was very young. We had a lot of career changers back in school. So I think the average age of a student was like 26. But that was like, you know, because there were some of us right out of high school. But most of the students studying painting were 30s, 40s, 50s. We had one woman who was 99, which I hope I live that long and I'm doing what she did.
And yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's funny because even my painting professors were like, oh, are you sure you want to go into painting? It's really difficult and this and that. So I became interested in computers in college when I was taking my electives. Mm-hmm. And that's why I decided when I went for my MFA to study animation. And it was a really broad program and it served me well because now we live in this world where it's hard to be a specialist because you can't really, it's hard to be an expert in anything related to computers because guess what? Everything's always changing.
Right.
Even by the day, by the week. So even if you master some software program or whatever, it doesn't mean that much in about a year. So my education was very broad. And so I got a little bit of graphic design and animation, et cetera. And so that served me teaching and moving forward. Anyway, I loved always to tell stories. So when I was a painter, it was narrative painting. And then that morphed into animations, which had a soundtrack, it had movement. But they weren't 3D computer animations like what you would see in Pixar or DreamWorks. I have friends who work for those companies, Disney, and you work in a big team. And if you're lucky, you might be able to animate some character's left elbow over 9 months. It's very detailed work, but you don't get a lot of control. And maybe I'm a little OCD, I don't know, but I just always like telling my stories. And I'd always just do that the old fashioned painterly way. So painting after painting after painting, throwing that in a video program and getting the paintings to move, adding my soundtracks. So that's kind of like what I was working on the last, you know, 2 decades. And I did international film festivals and things of that nature. And it's only since the pandemic that I really started going back to fine art because I got eye strain. I got tired of staring at my computer. And the power goes out a lot here and the internet goes out a lot here. And I have a good friend of mine, her name's Stacy Pawinski. She's a fabulous textile and artist and painter in Boston. And I visited her studio, I think in 2018, and she taught me how to weave on this Japanese loom. And that was just so cathartic. I mean, just so healing. And to sit in her studio for 2 hours and learn how to weave and no electricity, no internet needed, it really set me on a path for kind of reconnecting with my fine art roots. So to answer your question, my artwork is mixed media drawings. I like to use texture, explore texture, because you miss that on the computer sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I use watercolor pens and archival ink and fine tipped pens, small marks, small textures. And I'm inspired by stained glass windows. I'm inspired by textiles, especially in developing countries from Asia and Africa. Wood carving, mosaics, things like that. And so I'm basically trying to bring in all those textures and the content that I'm making. I don't know. It's almost like when I look at your work and Armin's work, you know, I know you're more abstract and his is really high, you know, realist and so precise. I feel like it's almost like a combination of those two things. It's colorful. but it's precise. I need my lines. I need my small marks. And yeah, I don't know if I've described it very well, but that's the start of it.
I think you have, because when I look at it, and you mentioned the weaving, learning how to weave. So I feel like the audience could visualize a woven, almost like a mandala woven, only in two dimension, you know, with all that intricate line and arm. And it reminds me of when you were drawing sweaters that weave up and down and up and down.
Oh, totally. No, don't remind me of that.
Oh, you love those sweaters. but it has a very...
It felt like it gave him a headache.
Yeah, I just gave him a headache, didn't I? But yeah. They're wonderful, wonderful. And you posted, I'm trying to remember exactly, because I shared it on my Facebook page and it started a lot of conversation with the audience here in the Midwest. And it was the one you had about climate, and it was the circle that had all the story. Tell me the story on that one again. It was such a great story.
Oh, thank you. Are you talking about the one that's like basically a year ago, I started, I didn't realize I was starting it at the time, but I guess a sacred geometry series.
Yes.
Are you talking about the one that's like the earth protection meditation, and it's like it's almost like a Celtic triquetra?
Yes.
Or are you? Okay.
That's the one.
Yeah. So that was the first one that I did. And it's funny because I didn't realize how precise you had to be when I started. I mean, thankfully that particular shape, the triquetra, is a protection symbol. And I work with UN organizations and NGOs and universities, and they all have these big lofty goals, and they have these visualizations. And so that kind of made me start to think about making these drawings that were global visualizations, not just at the individual level, but at the community and global level. And I thought I was looking at sustainable development goals that the UN has. There are 17 of them, but a lot of them focus on the climate, protecting the climate. And so this first one that I made is I used a triquetra, which is a sacred geometry Celtic symbol of protection. And then I'm like, okay, that's going to be my structure, but what am I going to fill it in with? So I started to put patterns from Asia, Europe, and Africa, because those were the three places that I had recently lived, and I wanted to represent those. And then different parts of the planet, so like the polar regions, the desert, the you know, rainforest, etc. And I tried to kind of put it all together and have it make sense. And when I was done with it, I was like, oh wow, you know, it was almost like in a trance when I made it. Yes. And that kind of led to other sacred geometry pieces. But that first one with that circle, I just eyeballed it, which I would never do now, because now I'm getting into sacred geometry symbols that are so precise that if you're even off by a hair, it messes up the whole thing. So I started using Vietnamese takeaway containers to get the circles, rulers. I was like, oh, I'm going to use rulers. What is this, geometry? I was told there would be no math. You know, this is so precise. And just recently, I started using a projector for the more complex images, because I really just wanted to get this like down, and then I can, you know, do everything over it, but just to not to mess up the proportions and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's been an interesting journey.
I bet, because it's so meditative, even to look at. It's very meditative.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Paraphrase something that you said in your artist statement is you're not creating a world that is, but a world that you would like it to be or it for you. Mm-hmm. And so that's an interesting statement, because being a realist, and I'm shifting too through iPhonography and all this other kind of stuff, but you know, I draw the world like it is, but not the world that people see, if that makes any sense. Only I see these little places, because everybody else is looking for sunsets and going on the beach, and I'm, you know, so that kind of reminded a little bit of what I do, but in a different setting, I suppose. But I really like that statement.
Yeah, that's a powerful statement.
With your work, Armin, just looking at it, but also reading a little bit about it, I think you mentioned like you're not just trying to reproduce what's in front of you, but you're trying to infuse it with your feelings about it. Is that right?
That's right. I build these places. I don't work from a reference photo. I build these places the way I want to build them. And so maybe that's an OCD thing. I want to be in control of it all. But I don't feel comfortable drawing off just a reference. You know, I made a living making portraits for a while in Chicago. And you had to work from usually a reference. And I just didn't feel like I was creating anything. I felt like I was just copying something. Yeah. So I had to change that. You know, and then the two of us, you know, Val and I, bring different things to the table. But we meld really well. You know, and I see our art changing because of each other.
That's interesting.
Right. Yeah, we want to talk about us. We want to talk about you. So I want to talk about us, but
I like to talk about your work as well, though. I mean,
I love conversations.
So different.
But I appreciate that.
Yeah, they go back and forth like that. It's
Val's having a show right now, a 3-person show, and when people walked in to see the real pieces, they were blown away by the scale because we see everything the same size now on the computer. Everything is it. You don't see the texture, see that size, even though it could be a mural, you see it that size. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the drawbacks about technology is that everything's kind of a face meal, which you really do.
I don't know how far away we are from this, but I can see it in my mind's eye. One day we'll, I don't know if it's like you need a headset or something, but even just with online teaching right now, you know, we're little floating boxes in a Zoom window right now.
Right.
But I do envision one day you put on your headset, you walk into the virtual classroom, people are in the same space, like almost like a hologram. And this one's in South Africa and this one's in Mexico and this one's in Cleveland, Ohio. And you can walk around the table and look over their shoulder at what they're doing.
And I don't think that's far away.
Yeah. And I think with art as well, I mean, there are some really clunky experiments in VR. I even had some VR art shows in the metaverse in the last, you know, year and a half.
Explain a little bit what VR means for our audience.
Virtual reality. So there's I'm trying to remember now the name. I think it was ArtGate VR, and they have a little wing in the metaverse. And actually, Stacy Pawinski, who inspired me to go back to fine art, we had a 2-person show together in the metaverse, and we had our artist talk, and she was in Boston and I was in Malawi. It was during the pandemic. We invited all our friends. They came to our little, you know, like virtual realm. But it was and if you had a headset, you could go in and you could look around this little virtual space, but it's very primitive. Almost reminds me of like a 3D Atari game or something. Yeah. It's very, or Pong, if you want to even go before that, just very clunky. So I think it will be more sophisticated maybe in the next 10 years, maybe less time than that. But I do have another friend that I studied painting with. He went into animation as well, Stephen Rogan, and he in Massachusetts as well. And he does these virtual reality murals where people are getting together to talk about something. It'll be like a chat room, and he'll be in the back making a mural. And people, if they just happen to turn around, they'll see him and interact with him making this mural. So it's interesting. It's interesting.
It is an interesting concept. Yeah. Wow.
That's very clunky and not very well developed yet, but one day.
Oh yeah. And it seems to go so fast, these changes. So probably sooner than we can even imagine. Love that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and then here we are in Malawi then the other side, you have people that they, you know, not many people have electricity, let alone, you know, a computer or the internet. So it's just, you know, the digital divide is real.
Yes. It sure is. Well, I know that in your class that I took with you, I learned so much about web design in particular, because I kind of used your website as a model, something to shoot for, because you have all the bells and whistles on there. I love your website. So I encourage folks to go to your website and just study it. If you're an artist thinking about adding all these components to your website, Kristen's is a great one. Is there a way folks can study with you? I want to say like semi-privately, privately on website design.
Yeah. So I have, as you, if someone is an emerging artist, I have the Masterious group. So those are the group sessions. And actually the group that I have right now are, it's funny because they all are mixed media artists that like to dabble in different disciplines, and they're all very interested in web and social media. So I didn't know, you know, like what they would, because every session is custom made for the group to custom what they want to do. And so I didn't want to impose on them, like, I'm social media and web, blah, 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 if they wanted to, you know, learn how to draw or something else. But they're actually very interested in that. So on one hand, that's an option. But then if you go to my website, I also do one-on-one, you know, sessions with people. I also, obviously you have to be in Lilongwe, Malawi, but I'm training someone who works for the World Health Organization, a local Malawian, on video editing and graphic design and communications. Mm-hmm. So we meet once a week, but then I also have my group classes here. So there's many different options. I think I just try to meet people wherever they are. And then I work with self-taught artists, because they're not really our universities here or training here. So you get a lot of people that are amazing. They just persevered when like the whole world was against them, and somehow managed to still be making art, even though they didn't have the training or the supplies or the role models. So I just try to meet people where they are. And I try to help people who are artists. And then I help people who maybe are not artists, but maybe they're an entrepreneur or a NGO, or a small organization, and they want to better, you know, like communicate with their audience and want to do that with their website or through social media, building relationships, which we talked about in our class a lot, right?
We sure did. And if you were, these all kind of roll around artists obtaining more knowledge but getting it in a way that's not intimidating to them. You say you're meeting us where we are, which is so appreciative, because a lot of times we don't know what to ask because we don't know enough about it. So you're filling in some of those blanks. So in that spirit, can you give us a few tips of advice for artists? 3, 4, 5, whatever. But in your mind's eye, how you see artists building their business, building their art, creating their art. Fun facts. Sure.
Fun facts. Sure. Well, I guess going back to our earlier conversation about neurodiversity just like taking, I feel like no matter what you do or wherever you're coming from, it could be, I have this condition, or, I don't have art supplies. Oh, I live in not a weird part of the world, but a part of the world where there are no art supply stores or galleries or people doing this. I would say take what you think is your biggest weakness and make it your biggest strength. Mm. Maybe Armin draws the way he does because he's so hyper-focused on little details, or, you know, your beautiful, colorful, abstract artworks and building them based on how you see the world. And in my case, when I was applying to graduate school, I was afraid they weren't going to accept me because I was coming from a painting background and I never owned a computer and I was applying to do computer graphics. So I thought my biggest weakness was the fact I was a painter. But then when I applied, I said, well, let's make that the special thing about me, that maybe the computer people don't know as much about color or texture or brush strokes or, you know, or narrative or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then with my with my students here, like Malawi is such a wonderful country. It's known as the warm heart of Africa, but in the global conversation, those voices are not well represented. So when there's a grant or a fellowship or a art contest, I try to encourage my Malawian students. I'm like, apply, because even just the fact that you're coming from Malawi and telling those stories, that's going to make you stand out. Mm-hmm. You know, like I sometimes joke, I'm like, nobody wants to hear from another American like me, you know, like in this global competition global where they're going to have 500 Americans or 5,000 Americans applying. You know, if you're like the one Malawian applying, like that's going to be special. Or even just in the larger continent of Africa, you get a lot of people maybe from Kenya, Nigeria, maybe Ethiopia, definitely South Africa, but not Malawi. Mm-hmm. So I just say whatever it is that you think is your weakness, make that your strength. I have a refugee student from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that for many people would be like a major weakness. Like, oh my gosh, you know, how can he make art when he's self-taught and living under such rough conditions and in a camp and, you know, has to ask people if he can come and go. You know, that's actually been a strength for him in terms of us working together, doing mural projects together. Uh-huh. So whatever it is.
Yeah. Oh, that is.
That's good. Really good advice.
It really is. I want to wrap my head around that and write about that in my journal because weakness and turning it into something very powerful. That's such a good way.
Your uniqueness.
Yes.
It's the thing that you do that's because I don't know. There was a quote I saw and I'm paraphrasing it because I don't remember what it was, but it was something like everybody's born an original, but so many die a copy.
Yeah.
Everyone's just trying to be like everyone else and that's lame.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, at the very beginning of our talk, you brought up generational gaps. So sometimes I look at a weakness for me in particular would be it would be aging, is getting older, you know, that can tend in society to be a weakness. How do I flip that to a strength? And, you know, mastery is, of course, is helping with the mentorship, the expert level that age can bring you. But I feel like generations need to think of what their generations might be perceived weaknesses. You know, we hear a lot of different things on each generation and then flipping that into a strength, you know, I'm thinking millennials, maybe they're looked on as, oh, okay, kind of out there and
you
flip
have
that,
boomers.
The technology knowledge.
You know, this boomer thing going on where
the boomers, which I am,
the most annoying thing about boomers. And I read that and I don't any of those things. you know, a phone in the house that's still hooked up to a land. I'm an evolving person. I'm not doing what I did in the 70s.
You're turning it into a strength, that's for sure. Right. Gen X, you're Kristen, Gen X.
And drawing my weakness would be feet. I don't like to draw feet, but I will not turn that into my strength because I don't want to draw feet.
Yeah, you got to pick your battles, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Gosh, it's great words to think about. It fires up the imagination because you can take that right into a critique, you know. What do you think is your biggest weakness in this painting? And then,
how can you flip the script and make that like the thing that you're known for?
That's
you
right.
You know, and having a weakness is like a shame sometimes. Like you want to hide it from people. Well, why not highlight it instead? But then that requires you to get out of your comfort zone and really kind of put yourself out there, right?
It's so true. Exactly. You know, a painting that might, to me, I've been accused of being a little busy in my work. Okay, so flip it and make it even busier.
Exactly. Go. Yeah, like multidimensional.
Go for it. Yeah.
You can do a multiverse.
That's right. Interesting. Oh, I appreciate that so much. So we can find you at your website. Tell us your website again.
Sure. You can go to kpalana.com. Which is maybe the easiest way, easiest place to go. So that's my first initial, K, and then Palana, PALANA.com. That's my big website that has everything. Wonderful. You'll find my shop and mentorship and the courses and all of that good stuff. I like to think I at least tried to organize it well.
Yes.
So you hopefully can find what you're looking for.
It looks great, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And it's easy to navigate.
I really was into the colors. So I'm like trying to get the color psychology right.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. So everybody can find all about you there. Of course, we're going to be putting it in the show notes as well. And I know you've been following our podcast. We so appreciate that, Kristen. You've been talking about it to your friends. We appreciate that so much. And all of you listeners, that you can't imagine how much that will help build what we're doing. We just started a Patreon account. I don't know. Have you ever done a Patreon?
Wow, really? I want to see that. Will you give me the link?
It's in the very beginning stages. And we're doing memberships. Oh, not a member. It's like a... to show love for the podcast. It'll help us a little bit with the productions and all that stuff. But we're anxious to see where that takes off so people can find that out there too.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, you know, being afraid of something, but staring it in the face. This podcast came about that. We had no idea, you know, and so right in the middle of COVID, we said, we're going to do this. And we you know, we're intelligent people. We can figure this out. Do we have, do we have bumps and lumps and everything?
We do have bumps and lumps.
But
getting there is half the fun, right?
Yeah.
Don't scare yourself away from doing things because it's hard. You know, art is hard.
Yeah. You know, but it's rewarding. That's the whole thing.
It's rewarding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So true.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this episode 57 with Palana. And keep in touch with us. Let us know what you think about this episode and check out her website for sure. Three wonderful sessions of residency over the course of the summer have now been completed at Golden Apple Residency. The 2023 artists and writers had the opportunity to immerse themselves in a nurturing and trusted space. Artists need that in their lives. Consider your own time in Down East Maine and discuss your options of dates with artist and director Shelley Stevens. She can be emailed at snstevens@goldenapplestudio.com. That's snstevens@goldenapplestudio.com. Thank you for your sponsorship of Art Ladders, Shelley. This just in from Golden Apple Studio in Residency. Session 3 of 2024, between the dates of August 18th to 31st, is available for a writer, playwright, or composer. There is a quiet, private, fully furnished apartment with a studio overlooking the bay available. It's a wonderful opportunity to start outlining a new project, continue a work in progress, do editing, or put the final touches on a manuscript. So if you are a writer, a playwright, or composer, contact Shelley Stevens. Thank you for listening. You can find our past and future episodes at anchor.fm, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Be sure to follow us on our Facebook page, Art Ladders, The Creative Climb with Valerie Allen and Armin Mersman. Special thanks to our producer, Taylor Kramer of Cold Shower Media.
And check out our websites, valerieallenart.com, arminmersman.com. Stay creative, stay curious, and we'll see you next time.